Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Tammy Freeman, and I'm joined today by Hamish Johnston, Margaret Harris, and later also Mateen Jirani.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi. So in this week's podcast, we'll be discussing a new take on the ever-popular double-slit experiment. And we'll also find out how a skiing trip last week inspired Hamish to investigate the physics of the pistes. But first, sand. A team from the University of Cambridge has found that sand dunes interact with each other as they move across the landscape. Hamish, how does this dune-to-dune communication work?
Well, according to these researchers, it's a process that involves turbulence in a fluid, and that fluid could be air or water, as it flows over the dunes. Now, of course, dunes are formed by the flow of air or fluid in the first place. And the best way to think about this is if you imagine two sand dunes that are aligned along the direction of fluid flow. The fluid travels over the first or upstream dune, and that creates a sort of a downstream turbulence. And apparently, it's that downstream turbulence that sort of pushes a bit harder on the second dune.
Okay.
And so the overall effect of this is to push the dunes apart. It's essentially a repulsive force between the dunes.
And that's all without like the dunes sort of exchanging sand at all. So this is purely through like the air flowing around them, not like the sand itself.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, that's something that's unique about this research. Scientists have known about dune-dune interactions in the past. And in fact, that's why we have these lovely patterns of sand dunes, because they are somehow interacting with each other and organizing themselves into a pattern. But all those sort of previous models had to do with sand blowing off one dune and landing on another dune. And that sort of is an interaction and an exchange of mass between the dunes. But apparently this is the first evidence for dune-to-dune interaction without the exchange of any sand.
Oh, okay. And how did the researchers investigate this phenomenon? Were they out in the desert monitoring the movement of the sand?
No, they were very much in their lab in Cambridge. And their setup, and if you go to my article, actually not my article, an article written by Michael Allen on the website, you can see a movie of their experimental setup. And what they've got is a cylindrical tank of water that has spinning paddles. And these paddles just create a circular current in the water. And they placed two piles of sand, so two sand dunes, that each comprised about 2.5 kilograms of sand. I think it was actually colored glass beads.
Okay.
So they could really keep
fake
an eye.
Sand.
Fake sand, that's right, yeah. They could keep an eye on what was going on. And I suppose by observing the dunes as they moved in this current, they were able to work out that there is a force. I suppose you'd think immediately from this, well, this only applies to sand dunes that form underwater. And of course, there are sand dunes underwater. But the researchers do say that it should also occur to sand dunes that are blown by the wind.
Can you imagine doing a PhD that just involves you going in and playing with sand in water every day? That just, it sounds like, it's fascinating physics, but it sounds like it might be really hard to explain to skeptical relatives or something. You know, what is he doing? I mean, this PhD of yours?
And the other thing is, when go look at the video and you see this thing going around. And I really have to wonder, what else, have they put into this tank? Have they put, rubber ducks or something to see if there's a...
Lego figures.
Exactly, yeah. A force between rubber ducks or maybe Star Wars Lego figures. Could they generate a force between them? It looks like a lot of fun, actually, this tank. Although I'm sure they're very serious.
Yeah, it does. I mean, besides being a lot of fun, I mean, why are these findings so important?
Well, I think the crucial thing is that, when you see these fields of sand dunes, either, sort of in the desert or on a coastline, they are created by interactions. And it's very important to understand these interactions, because you could, for example, use that understanding to prevent desertification. Did I say that properly? You know, a desert expanding into an agricultural area, for example, if you had a handle on the interactions and the physics involved. And, you know, the flip side of that is that that understanding could be used to rehabilitate coastal dunes, you know, if they're damaged by development or by a serious storm or something like that. Understanding sand dunes is very important. And in general, understanding granular materials, the physics of granular materials, is very important as well, because they're just about everywhere in our lives, you know, from foods to construction materials. And I think later on we're going to talk about snow, which also is a granular material that is of great interest
indeed
to scientists. Yeah.
So the full details of this study can be found in the article "Sand Dunes Repel Each Other as They Move Across a Landscape," written by Michael Allen. So moving from sand dunes to snow dunes, sort of, namely moguls, which are ridges of snow that form on ski slopes once they've been skied on for a while. So Hamish, you saw a lot of these moguls on your skiing trip to Andorra last week. So what are they and how are they formed?
These are essentially dunes of snow. They tend to be about sort of a meter across, maybe, and tens of centimeters high. And they tend to form on steep-ish slopes that have a lot of ski traffic. And what happens, if you can imagine a freshly groomed, smooth, steepish slope, first thing in the morning at a ski resort, people start skiing down it. And in order to avoid going too quickly, most skiers will not plunge down the slope in a straight line, but they'll sort of slalom back and forth. Mm. And what happens when they do that is their skis push the snow into piles, and you get a sort of a track of snow in an S shape or a wiggle shape down the piste.
Oh, so these are actually naturally forming moguls, not sort of like moguls that have been set up by the ski resorts so that skiers can sort of practice going over them, as like you see in the Olympics doing tricks and that sort of thing.
No,
actually a natural effect.
Yeah, they emerge you know, through the actions of skiers. And then I think what happens is subsequent skiers will go down the slope and they'll sort of follow the path of the first skier. And eventually that will form moguls. So the skiers will come down, everybody will push a little bit of snow into a pile. And before you know it, the entire piste is covered in a, you know, almost like a matrix of moguls. And this seems to happen. It'll definitely happen. There was a famous piece called Directa, which has very steep at the top in Andorra. And if you go down it first thing in the morning, it's perfectly smooth. But by lunchtime, it's a field of moguls.
Oh, right.
So it really doesn't take that much time.
So you said how the moguls develop. What happens even later in the development after this sort of matrix of moguls has formed?
Yeah, there seems to be a sort of a two-step process here. First of all, the skiers create the field of moguls by essentially avoiding the hills of snow and sort of picking their way through them. But then at some point, the mogul field is just so dense that you can't really turn in it. And so what skiers tend to do then is they jump over the mogul in order to turn. And when you're parallel skiing, you turn by raising your upper body. And that's much, much easier to do when you go over a mogul. And so skiers will turn in a mogul field by topping the mogul and then turning and then sliding down the other edge of the mogul. And so as they're doing this, they're constantly pushing snow around the mogul field. And I suppose naively, you would think that all this downward pushing of snow would tend to push the moguls downhill. But You can see where I'm going here. That's not what happens. And that was discovered about 10 years ago by some researchers in Colorado. And what they did is they put a camera on an ungroomed mogul field. So this is a mogul field that has appeared, and then it's not bashed away every night. It stays there all ski season for mogul skiers to enjoy. And what they found is that the moguls are actually moving uphill. And I think over an entire season in Colorado, they found that an individual mogul moves 10 meters up a hill. That's about 8 centimeters a day or something like that during the ski season. And essentially what they found is that when the skiers were jumping over the mogul to turn, they were pushing snow from the uphill mogul into the downhill mogul. And the effect of that is that the sort of the center of mass of both of those moguls move uphill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting phenomenon. Apparently it happens in other parts of physics, of the behavior of complicated systems. I think in traffic sometimes it can happen.
Yeah, you sometimes see, like, if you're particularly on a bicycle or something, you often see, particularly on a very soft tarmacked road, you can see sort of grooves or bumps that have been worn in the pavement by heavy trucks. And they're not grooves, they're not straight grooves like where the wheels have gone. They're actually bumps that represent where the patterns of movement of the trucks have stopped, the lights and this sort of thing.
And it's... I mean, I find it fascinating, I suppose the people have studied it, but, I never would have guessed that the moguls actually move uphill. So, it was really interesting to, and I discovered that. I mean, I have to say, I'm such a geek. I was, looking at these moguls as I was going up the chairlift, and then when it was time to have a coffee break, I was sitting there with my phone Googling it. And that's when I discovered this fantastic Colorado story. Yeah.
Whole rich thread of research is bunches of areas of physics where you naively think that, okay, the moguls that are being pushed downhill would end up going downhill. But then when you apply physics and you stop and think about it, oh, actually, the fact they move uphill makes sense.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I mean, it's a simple explanation. You combine, how even a sort of intermediate skier like me would go across a mogul with, a bit of thought. And yeah, of course, yeah, they move uphill. So yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Excellent. So, I mean, Hamish isn't the only one that's been out about in the snow lately. Margaret, you've actually just returned from Colorado, where you went cross-country skiing in Estes Park. So I guess moguls aren't as much of an issue there.
Well, no, yeah, because I mean, I leave the downhill skiing to crazy people like Hamish. I prefer to, if I'm going to fall off my skis, I want to do it at a very low speed. I've been out at a conference in California, and I then went to Colorado to visit some family and also to go cross-country skiing. So I also found myself thinking about physics because, like Hamish, I'm a big fat geek. And so the thing I was thinking about wasn't moguls. It was more about like the sort of friction between my skis and the snow, because I'm a very novice skier here. I think this is about the sixth time I've ever been skiing. And so when I've strapped on my cross-country skis, and made the mistake of doing so on a slight slope, I immediately started falling backward, which was, embarrassing, especially doing it in the car park. So what happens with cross-country skiing, naively you might think that it's completely flat, but in actuality, unless you're doing it on some sort of groomed trail, which I wasn't, there are little ups and downs. And there's a variety of ways of making sure you don't sort of fall backwards when you're cross-country skiing up a small rise. One is to just, brute force sort of stamp your skis really heavily into the snow. And then others use your poles. But then you can start to do like herringbone patterns where you put your skis at an angle and you sort of step up like that.
That's how they do it in the races, isn't they?
Yeah, that's how they do it if you're actually good and if there's a wide enough trail to do it on. I end up sort of doing the third way, which is sort of actually putting your skis perpendicular to the direction of the slope and just stepping sideways uphill. But that's really hard work, even more hard work than cross-country skiing usually is. So what we ended up using is something called skins, climbing skins. And this is a strip of material that has I think they were originally made of seal skin, but it's a sort of a directional fur on the back if you like. And these are strips of fabric with a directional fur on the back that means it's very easy to slide forward, but not easy at all to slide backward. You strap these things with glue onto the bottom of your skis and sort of buckle them on, and then suddenly you can just go walking nicely up the hill, which was great fun. It was much better than trying to sort of fall backwards down the hill.
And then when you go down again, do they stop you sliding down the hill? Or?
They do stop you sliding down the hill, which was fine for me because I'm really bad at sort of turning and carving. This all this sort of I'm in awe of people who can actually, you know, sort of navigate their way down a field of moguls. I sort of navigated my way into big piles of deep snow to sort of crash into softly if I wanted to stop. You can also sort of like take them off when you go downhill. So you take the trail up and you're using your skins do up the hill, and then you take them off to go down.
Okay. Hamish, I gather you had lots of snow in Andorra, which is relatively high altitude, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. There was a big dump of snow at the end of January.
Yeah.
And we were there last week, and, you know, there's still quite a bit of snow around. But, you know, unfortunately, it had been very warm, you know, sort of 8-10 degrees even during the day at, you know, an altitude of 2,500 meters.
Wow.
So, you know, it wasn't the greatest, and the snow was melting.
Yeah,
I think they were probably getting a bit worried.
And for some of the ski resorts in Europe, it's been so warm that they're really suffering from a lack of snow. So I know that a lot of large ski areas use snowmaking cannons to supplement if there's not been enough natural snowfall. Do these even work if it's that warm?
Well, that's another thing that I was obsessing about when I was skiing, even at night where we were. You know, we're at an altitude of over 2,000 feet, and it was above freezing at night, which is incredible. And I noticed that, you know, the snow cannons weren't on. They weren't using them on those evenings. And so that's when I got to think about, you know, what's the sort of limit of a snow cannon? How warm can it be for you to be able to use it? And it's interesting, snow cannon. There's a lot of physics involved.
Let me guess, you got your phone out while you're doing a bit of après ski and found out about snow cannons too.
I did. A lot of the sort of function of a snow cannon is down to the ideal gas law, which is PV equals NKT, if you cast your mind back to undergraduate physics or even before that, where P is pressure and T is temperature. And what most snow cannons do, I know that there are different ways of doing this, but they mix water with very high pressure air, and then that is blasted out through a nozzle over the pistes. And of course, when the high pressure mixture exits the nozzle, the pressure drops dramatically, and PV equals NKT. So that means that the temperature drops dramatically. And this is the sort of thing that, I mean, you really notice this if you've ever used a carbon dioxide fire extinguisher.
Oh, yeah.
Which blasts out carbon dioxide and essentially gets so cold that you can get frostbite from it if you touch the nozzle. Yeah. And so you've got an advantage there. So you're blasting out really cold water. So this allows tiny ice crystals to form and grow. And that's essentially your snow. So it's not like a snowflake. It's actually like a pellet.
Okay.
But, you know, that will work at relatively high temperatures to a certain extent because of the refrigeration effect.
But what's relatively high?
Well, that's an interesting question. I sort of delved into that in my blog, and it has to do with the relative humidity. So if the relative humidity is very high, forget it. You're not going to make snow even at, you know, 0 degrees.
Okay.
But if the relative humidity is about 50%, let's say, which is, you know, that's pretty low, but, you know, you might get it on a mountain.
You're definitely getting in Colorado. It's famous for being very, very low humidity there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You can actually make snow at just above freezing temperature. So you can just about make snow at about 0.5 degrees Celsius. So, you know, if you're really desperate, you might fire off your snow cannons when the temperature is just slightly above zero. Well, you know, that's great, but, you know, is that snow going to melt
when it hits the ground?
Is it going to stick around? I mean, I think really to operate these snow cannons, you have to have, you know, minus five or minus 10 degrees Celsius to really get the most efficient snow making out of them.
So what's going to happen as, you know, the climate crisis continues and it gets too warm to even to do sort of snow making at 0.5 degrees Celsius? I mean, you said that temperatures in Andorra were sort of 8 to 10 degrees. I mean, what kind of future is that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I should say that most of the evenings we were there, it was cold enough for the snow cannons to be operated. And they even, I suppose they were so behind on their snow making, they were even running them during the day when it was cold enough. But yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think snow cannons aren't a panacea, but
they must use a lot of energy themselves.
Oh yeah, they do. And you know, I think really what the snow cannons can be used for is sort of, you know, to maybe extend the ski season, or I suppose with global warming, just maintain the ski season. I think skiers could be accused of being unrealistic about their demands for when they can go ski. You know, for example, in the US, skiers would like to be on the slopes at Thanksgiving, which is very early.
Late November.
Right. So, you know, that's probably very difficult to do in most places with natural snow. And in Europe, it's the other end of the season. A lot of people like to go skiing at Easter. And so, you know, I think originally these snow cannons were developed to offer a way to extend the season out in both directions. And, you know, there's some things that ski resorts can do. They're tend to be very clever about making snow when they can and capturing that snow and hiding it. So when you're around a ski resort, you'll come across a huge pile of snow that's sitting in the shade. And that's been put there for a, well, rainy day to
literally
be used later.
Or a sunny day.
Yeah. But Margaret, you're right. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of energy and cost involved in snow making. And apparently, you know, most, you know, like a ski area, 25% of its operating costs during a season can be down to snowmaking. And, you know, that's piping water and producing compressed air, you know, the energy involved in that. And also there's also there can be a significant disruption of the local hydrology, because normally what's done is meltwater is captured in reservoirs, and you see these reservoirs when you're up skiing, and so, you know, you're disrupting the alpine environment by putting lots of water onto the piste and then capturing it and holding it. And then another problem, sort of ironically, with global warming is that you're putting all this snow onto the piste and it's actually staying there longer, much longer than it should. And that can have a huge impact on the plants that grow on that piste, because, you know, they're normally the snow would be gone by the beginning of April.
Yeah.
But because you put all this artificial snow on and piled it up.
Like you're delaying spring.
Exactly.
The
flowers
can't come through.
You know, it's like a huge turkey that takes forever to defrost.
You get a bit of a reverse issue in Colorado, certainly with the natural snow there, because so I've only ever visited Colorado in the summer previously. And then it's like, oh, you can't go off trail because, you know, the growth rate of some of these alpine plants is measured in millimeters per year, so you don't want to be your nasty big hiking boots that are stomping all over it. It was actually revelation for me to go there in the winter, because snow is considered a durable surface. You can tramp all over snow off trail if you like, and it's not going to hurt the plants underneath. So that's, you know, it's weird that there's a different way of looking at the impact of skiing on the environment in different countries.
Yeah. Well, I think downhill, I mean, definitely a downhill piste is a, you know, it's a very artificial system. Is, you know, it is like a turkey that's you've taken out of the freezer and takes a long time to thaw. It's, you know, this very compressed snow that is probably no good for anything that happens to be trying to grow underneath it. But yeah, it was, you know, it was very interesting. I mean, I've been skiing for a few years, but this is the, I think because of the, you know, the warm temperatures and the conditions of the snow, it was the first time that I really thought about things like moguls and snow making. So yeah,
great.
It was a great week, both in terms of skiing and physics.
Okay, so you can read more about the physics of snow in Hamish's blog article, Gravity-Defying Ski Moguls and Snowmaking in Warmish Weather. Now I'm here with Mateen, who is going to talk about the feature Double Slits with Single Atoms, which describes a new variant of the classic Young's Double Slit experiment. Now, Mateen, I'm sure all our listeners know, but can you just remind us of what the double slit experiment is?
All right, well, I'll start at the very beginning. So back in 1804, Thomas Young, who was a scientist and I think a bit of a polymath, he basically did an experiment that I think most physicists probably learnt at school. And it involved shining light through two narrowly placed slits. And as you probably know, that on a distant screen, Thomas Young saw a pattern of light and dark fringes. And he concluded from that that light is behaving as a wave. And that was a big deal at the time because everyone since Isaac Newton had thought light was a particle. So that sort of transformed physics. So that's what the original, the Young's double slit experiment was all about. And it proved that light is a wave and can interfere. So you get the constructive and destructive interference pattern.
Okay, so according to the author of this feature, who is Andrew Murray from the University of Manchester, the double slit experiment that really confirmed wave-particle duality was not Young's experiment from 1804, but more recent work by Roger Bark and co-workers at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and they used lower energy electrons. So can you tell us about those experiments?
Yeah, it's complicated because basically this guy, Andrew Murray, he interviews a lot of students who want to study physics at Manchester, and they all go, oh, we love Young's double slit experiments because it showed wave particle duality. And the thing was, it was carried out in 1804 when nobody knew about electrons and nobody knew about quantum physics. So it had nothing to do with wave particle duality. It's kind of got a bit mixed up. So the point is, in this feature, he then takes us forward to 1961, where there's this guy called Klaus Janssen in Germany. And he did a similar experiment to Young's. So he machined some slits into copper. And then rather than firing light at it, he fired a beam of electrons. And the electrons also created an interference pattern, just like the interference pattern Thomas Young saw with light. So he was doing it with electrons. So that showed that electrons, a beam of electrons, can behave like a wave. But that didn't actually mean that each electron on its own has a wave-like character. And so Richard Feynman, the famous physicist in the 60s, said, ooh, if you could turn down the intensity of the electron beam really low so there's only ever one electron at a time going through the slits, then that would prove it. And of course, for a long time, that was just a thought experiment. Mm. No one had the technology to do it. And eventually, as you said, there was this experiment in 2013, two centuries after Thomas Young's original one, by this guy, Roger Back, at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. So he fired electrons at two slits, 62 nanometers wide, and he was able to lower the intensity of the electron beam right down, really low. And he concluded that only one electron was present between the source and the detector at any one time. So what happens is the electrons go through the slits and they arrive on the screen one by one, and in a seemingly random style. But over time, you get an interference pattern.
Yeah.
Even though only one electron at a time was going through the slits, which is really weird. And that was the experiment that proved.
The real proof,
yeah. The real proof that electrons, each one, has wave-particle duality. And the point Andrew Murray is saying was when his students come to study physics at Manchester, it's really that experiment that is the one that proves wave-particle duality.
Yeah, yeah.
So Andrew Murray and his research group, they've recently found an entirely new way to carry out this experiment. So what did they do?
So yeah, it takes a long while in the article to get to the point of what Andrew Murray's done. He's done a completely new type of Young's double slit experiment, and it doesn't involve shining light or electrons at slits. Instead, what he does is he fires laser beams at rubidium atoms. And by firing the laser at the atom, it excites the atoms, which then go down to a lower state. And then somehow he uses other lasers to fire again at the rubidium atoms, and they spit out photoelectrons. And basically, he looks at the photoelectrons that are ejected by these lasers, and they essentially, there are basically two sort of paths that the electrons can take to get out. And it's a bit like in a Young slit experiment, you can turn off one of the slits or the other. In this experiment, you can basically turn off one pathway or the other.
Okay.
And so what you end up with is an interference pattern, not on a screen, but you get an interference pattern of various properties as a function of the angle that the electron's emitted at. So he's saying this is a fantastic new way of exploring the concept of Young's double slits in an entirely new way. And of course, you might be saying to me, I can see you wondering what the hell this has anything to do with anything. He claims in the article that this could have really interesting applications. First of all, in terms of understanding how distant stars behave.
Okay.
And the second one is that old classic, could help with quantum computers.
Yeah.
Not quite sure how, but definitely worth reading the article to find out more about this very strange experiment and the long backstory of Young slits. In fact, Tammy, it was number one on the Physics World website since it went live last week. So
everyone wants to find out about it.
Everyone wants to find out, and the author's really chuffed that
excellent.
It had done that well.
Well, the feature, Double Slits with Single Atoms, can be found in the February 2020 issue of Physics World. And as Mateen says, it's also available online. So thanks to Mateen, Margaret and Hamish for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. And we're also on Spotify. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next week. Physics World.